we picked, when it came to the apps, privacy. And we didn't really weigh it against anything else. And that's just crazy. We're hurtling towards almost 250,000 deaths. And we're on track to lose 4% of GDP. But the only thing we can do with apps is protect privacy, and that's got to be the priority. And then let's see if it works. I mean, it's just crazy. There's so much room to do even a little bit more at actually fairly minimal cost to privacy. There are so many more possibilities to try to make these apps work that, you know, it wouldn't have saved all those lives and it wouldn't save all that GDP. But man, it sure could have done something.
I'm Alan Rosenstein, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, December 22nd, 2020. In the early months of the COVID-19 pandemic, digital technology was touted as a potential savior. In particular, there was a burst of enthusiasm around so-called digital contact tracing apps, which would track people's movements and interactions and notify them if they had been exposed to COVID. Apple and Google, which together control the operating systems for virtually the entire smartphone market, joined forces and created a standard to help researchers, private entities, and governments create contact tracing apps. But despite the early hype, enthusiasm about these apps quickly fizzled, and even today, they remain underdeveloped and rarely used. Jane Bambauer and Brian Ray are law professors at the University of Arizona and the Cleveland Marshall College of Law. As part of Lawfare's ongoing digital social contract research paper series, they just published a paper titled, "COVID-19 Apps Are Terrible. They didn't have to be." I spoke with Jane and Brian about why contact tracing never played more than a marginal role in managing the pandemic. It's the Lawfare Podcast, December 22nd. Jane Bambauer and Brian Ray on the lost promise of digital contact tracing. So let's start by talking about the state of COVID apps today. You open your paper with the example of an app that's currently being used at the University of Arizona. Jane, since that's where you teach, let me start with you. How's the app been performing?
Well, we don't really know. So I'll tell you, it's been downloaded more times than I, you know, feared that it would or thought that it would. It's been downloaded by members of the University of Arizona community about 18,000 times, and there are 45,000 of us here. So, you know, it hasn't reached the halfway point, but that's still better than the frequency of downloads that I've seen in other studies of app performance. But what I don't know is how often people who have tested positive for COVID have relayed that information through the app. And I don't know how many people have gotten an exposure notification. And then as our paper mentions, one of the funny features of one of the unnecessary design flaws of this app is that you actually have to like go ahead and open the app on your phone to see if you've had an exposure notification. So even if there has been a notification message, I don't know what proportion of those messages have been viewed and viewed in time to make a difference. So a lot of unknowns, but at least there seems to be an appetite for this sort of app based on the download figures.
And let's just talk a bit more in detail about what this app does. So I think in the popular imagination, there's a sense that what a COVID app would do is you would download it onto your smartphone and then it would know where you are and it would know who's around you. And then there'd be some central system and automatically you just get all these alerts constantly about whether you've been exposed or not. What does the Arizona app do in particular, and how representative is it of COVID apps in general that are in development?
Yeah. So no, the app doesn't work anything like that. The app is one of the so-called decentralized apps. So anyone who downloads the COVID Watch app, their own phone records these special codes of all the phones that they come in near contact with. It uses low emission Bluetooth to sense which phones are near it, and it collects a code, you know, a special code emitted by those other phones at the time that you're near the phone. And then later on, if somebody whose code has been collected on your own phone tests positive for COVID, and you know, assuming that they also have been running the app, of course, they can, with the help of the public health authority, in this case, it's the University of Arizona's, the campus health program, they can report that positive test through the app. And then your own phone So nobody, there's no central system. It's just that your own phone every day goes through the logs of the special codes or numbers of the phones that have now reported a positive test. And if those numbers, that roster of numbers matches any of the numbers that your phone has stored in the last, I'm forgetting how many days, 14, 20 days, Brian, if you know, step in here.
I think it's 14.
14, yeah. So then it alerts you that one of the phones that's in your phone's list of, you know, one of the codes that's in your phone's list of codes that you've been nearby and for long enough to bother recording the code, one of those people has tested positive. So it does not know where you are. It doesn't know where you were when you were exposed. And it only reports at the level of the day that you were exposed. So it won't even tell you, you know, a precise time so that you could kind of figure out where you were. And if you were in the context where you were just, you know, outside or with a mask, you know, you can't sort of do your own estimate of risk outside of just knowing which day the exposure or potential exposure took place.
Brian, let me turn to you next.
Yeah. So just to amplify on a few things. So the Arizona app is one of the early examples of apps that were developed to ride on the Google Apple system, which is an API that they created to both allow Android and iOS system-based phones to work with one another, which wasn't possible before, and crucially to allow the Bluetooth system on those phones to run in the background, which as a privacy-preserving and security-preserving feature is disabled. Most apps can't allow or trigger Bluetooth to run in the background so that it's just going even while you're using other apps. So those were the two sort of key technical breakthroughs. And initially, they required an app to be developed by each jurisdiction, which was either a country or a state. And in Arizona's case, Arizona is a state-based one. And so it had to be developed either in collaboration with or directly by a state entity, usually public health authority. They've since done a further iteration. So now it sits in the background on the hardware of the phones. And so if you go into any iPhone, regardless of whether your state has a sanctioned system or not, you'll see exposure notification. And so it sits there now as a capability that any state can turn on if they want to. And you don't even need an app, which, you know, could make things much easier. But many states simply aren't interested, including my home state, Ohio, and they refused the offer, as it were, to use this capability. And then you asked about other apps that are out there and how this works in comparison to other apps. Well, the hard reality now is that there really aren't any other apps functionally in use, none in the United States, that are different from Apple and Google, because when Apple and Google created this standard structure, they limited it to apps that used only this Bluetooth capability. And again, only apps that were sanctioned, one app per jurisdiction. And so that functionally simply turned off a really interesting and creative set of other alternatives that were beginning to develop within the United States, at least. Now, some countries like Australia went ahead and used their own app that doesn't take advantage of the Apple Google technology. But many countries in Europe, for example, tried to fight with Apple and Google and tried to get access to this capability, even with their own design app, which had different functionalities, but they lost those battles. And so now, at least within Europe and the United States, functionally, the only app that's out there is this, and it's limited to Bluetooth.
Yeah. So basically, any public health authority that wants to roll out an app has to choose between geolocation information or Bluetooth. You can't do both because of the Apple Google requirements.
And just to be clear, why is it that jurisdictions that are reliant or that want to use the Bluetooth functionality have to go through the Apple Google system? Is it because Apple and Google have locked down the Bluetooth capability on the phones that run their operating systems, which is virtually all smartphones in use?
Exactly.
Yeah, it's the app market.
Yeah. So you can use, and this is what some of the early apps before Apple and Google announced that they were going to allow Bluetooth to turn on in the background. There were some workarounds. The UK app had a workaround, but they were clunky and they tended to drain battery power pretty quickly, and they just didn't work that well. So you could still do that in theory. You could create an app that includes GPS and then does a workaround to try to keep Bluetooth on, but you won't be able to use this very nice capability that Apple and Google have created, and it won't talk. Android and iOS phones won't talk to each other if you use that workaround.
And I'm not sure, Brian, are you sure that they would even allow that type of an app in the App Store? I mean, I guess if it's not
right.
Using
so, their... Yeah, no, that's a great question, Jane. So the other thing that Apple and Google did, and again, we're beating them up a little bit here, but you know, there were good reasons for why they were doing this. It's just, in our view, they went too far. But in terms of controlling contact tracing apps in the App Store, there have been a number of fraudulent apps that were simply trying to steal things from you, you know, or get you to give money that, you know, that and a lot of contact tracing related scams going on. So there's good reason why they're trying to control that. But you're right. I'm not sure that they would even allow. It's a good question. They might. I mean, they might allow a country sponsored app or state sponsored app that did something different, but they won't allow it to use this capability. And this capability is very powerful. It's just not as powerful as it could be if it were layered on to GPS. So the other really promising model that was moving very quickly within the US was what an MIT group had developed called SafePass. And SafePass is still out there. They've just pivoted it so that it no longer works the way they initially envisioned, which was starting with using GPS, allowing users to collect GPS data within their own phone and then consent to sharing with a public health authority if they tested positive, and then connect that with the Bluetooth. And the reason why GPS plus Bluetooth is more powerful than Bluetooth alone or GPS alone is that they both work differently and they have different strengths. And I'm not a technologist, so I don't know the precise details, but as I understand it from, you know, having immersed myself in the technology literature here, is GPS isn't very good at that very approximation of that very close 6-foot range, which is the standard that we're using, that scientists guess is the best estimation for when you're really at risk of being exposed, and also estimating that time. But GPS is more accurate for broader distances, and put together would allow you to not only figure out that, hey, I was within 6 feet for 15 minutes of someone at some point in time, but exactly where that happened. And so if you don't remember exactly what you did with your phone during the day, you could figure out, oh, you know what, that was at noon when I was on the Lawfare podcast. You know what? My phone was in my car, or you know, I had left it in my office, and I was, you know, in this quiet room, and so I actually wasn't exposed. Or, oh, I know what was going on. Well, I was sitting there, and you know, we had masks on, and we actually were 15 feet apart. But you know, Bluetooth, because of the way it works, it's not always that terribly accurate. And so you can figure out that, you know what, no, it must have been, you know, this must have been a false positive here, and I don't actually have to quarantine.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, maybe generalizing a little bit more, you know, there's a reason that South Korea, for example, uses multiple types of data in order to triangulate to get a better estimate of risk, and then to make better, you know, more efficient, wiser decisions about resources, but also quarantine recommendations too. And so when you're limited, you know, the Bluetooth Apple Google system is great for many of the reasons that Brian said, that it can rule out times. Like one good example is, you know, if you're on different floors of the same building and GPS has a hard time disambiguating that, Bluetooth emissions can help do that. But of course, it will not perform as well as Bluetooth plus GPS, or other types of data that can help get at risk with more precision.
And then the big pieces, and this is, you know, this is where the privacy issues come to a head, and where you are talking about trade-offs, is that, you know, Bluetooth, because it doesn't reveal where you were, you can disclose it with confidence that it can't really be reused for very much other than that you were in close contact with the other, you know, the other person, which is masked through these anonymized identifiers that are used. Whereas GPS is, you know, discloses something that's potentially sensitive about you, and especially persistent GPS data over time, right, can reveal quite a bit about you, even, you know, and is much easier to re-identify even if it's anonymized. But that's what we're doing with manual contact tracing, and we do it for a good reason, right? If you test positive, you're going to get a call from a public health authority, and they're going to ask you to tell them not only best guess where you were over the past 14 days, but how you live your life generally, so that they can try to prompt you to remember that, oh yeah, actually I was here and these people might have been exposed, right? And so that's what we're doing, and we do it for good reason in the context of a public health emergency like this. Adding GPS certainly increases the privacy risks over Bluetooth, but in ways that we're already doing, and for the very good reason that we're trying to help public health authorities do this job of contact tracing much faster and much better. And so that's one of the main reasons that SafePath, for example, started out with GPS, is because it's more useful in that context immediately. And the other thing is, in terms of scale, Bluetooth only works when you've got a fairly large system, because all it's doing is sending out these random identifiers that have to connect with someone else in order to work. Whereas GPS, even if I'm the only one collecting my own GPS data, if I test positive, that's useful to the public health authority because it can make it much easier and more accurate for them to do that contact tracing process.
You mentioned the privacy angle, so I want to turn to that for a second. There's a lot of skepticism, and this is especially true in the privacy community and the digital civil society groups. There's a lot of skepticism that COVID contact tracing apps can do much good, especially relative to their costs. And we have just talked about, you know, how complicated it would be to set them up and how much data a really effective Bluetooth plus GPS enabled app would do. So I'd love to get your thoughts on why you think COVID apps are still, despite all these potential costs, worth really investing in.
Yeah, it's a great question. And to be clear, one of the things that we're not saying is that we're 100% confident that these apps under any configuration definitely would work, you know, really, really well. But the problem that we're calling out and the confounding reality that we're dealing with right now is that we never really gave them a chance to see if they could work well and what kinds of privacy trade-offs we might either be willing to make or that we might be able to make better by refining the technology. Instead, what happened really early on, because of the choice that Apple and Google made, which was driven by a larger context of substantial and justified public distrust of both government and the big technology companies, as well as early moves by the European Data Protection Board, forced us into this sort of technology corner where we're only using, most countries are only using the Bluetooth-only app. And while that's a powerful tool to some extent on its own, it really raises or diminishes the possibility that these apps could work really, really well. And so we never got a chance to test how that might work together.
Yeah, in a nutshell, the sort of privacy advocates and advocacy groups that have commented on COVID apps start with the presumption that they must meet an extremely high standard for privacy, you know, decentralized data collection, collecting the sort of data that could not only not be accessible, but even if somehow it's accessed, it wouldn't be able to be traceable to any individual. So if you start with that level of a requirement for, you know, very, very minimal privacy risk, then what you're left with is not a lot of functionality. And so it's almost a foregone conclusion that the apps are not going to be very useful. Brian and I don't have, we see things very similarly, but there are some points of departure. And so maybe I'll draw out a couple of those, because yeah. I feel more confident saying that we definitely could have an app that's effective. And the reason I feel comfortable saying that is twofold. One is that when tracking people and predicting things about them is in a company's own interest, they do it pretty well. Not perfectly, but they add tremendous value in terms of prediction and resource allocation. And so that's sort of a general, you know, observation. And then the second observation comes from comparison countries like South Korea. I use South Korea as the best example because it had started getting out of control cases, runaway community spread around the same time that the US had. and was able to harness not only data. I don't want to give the impression that everything boils down to the use of data, but one of the ways in which it really got on top of the virus to the point where they could suppress it was the use of the types of data that we know we could collect and use. And then finally, I guess the other difference between Brian and I think, is that Brian thinks that a lot of this flows from a justified distrust that has emerged over the last, you know, decade or two, based on government and large company abuse of data. And I'm not so sure about that. I think that much of the distrust that, you know, not much of the distrust in society in general, but especially toward use of data and you know, what I think could be smart use of personal data, is not entirely justified. That it comes from a somewhat paranoid stance that doesn't really think through what the likely risks are, what the chance that they will materialize are, and then what the benefits of, you know, collective action and pooling of data could be.
Brian, let me turn then to this issue of justified risk. So, you know, as you and Jane pointed out in your paper, the debate over COVID apps isn't happening in a vacuum. It's not just about COVID apps. Right. There's this background of public sentiment about surveillance. There's a background of public opinion about technology companies, the so-called tech lash. So we just heard Jane's thoughts on that. I'm curious to get yours on how that's affecting COVID app development and whether that's justified.
Yeah. And so just to take a step back and comment briefly on Jane's point, what's nice about this is Jane and I disagree on a lot of things, but we're sort of, there's so much room to agree, regardless of where you fall specifically on what should have happened, as to how, you know, how sort of wrongheaded our current approach and the political climate around apps is, that it's easy to write a paper like this. And we sort of fell over ourselves in agreeing with things, in spite of the fact that we disagree on certain things, which aren't only on the margins. But in terms of, you know, the tech lash question and use of data, yeah, I mean, I would put myself, you know, probably more on the spectrum towards a tech skeptic and have pretty deep concerns about surveillance creep. In fact, you know, most of the work that I've done has been sort of looking at the risks as opposed to considering the benefits. But this is a context where we have clear potential benefits, right? I want to circle back a little bit to the efficacy of these apps. But if there was ever a reason to try to exploit data to good ends that are, you know, unobjectionable, it's this, right? And the concerns are both outsized and relate to a context that's very, very different, right? This is not big tech trying to steal our data and figure out ways to monetize it without telling us or rewarding us. This is big tech, really, you know, they really are. They're actually, the reason they ended up with boots to the line is they're afraid of the downside risk, and they don't see very much upside risk in producing a good app in this context. And then in terms of the government surveillance risk, this is very, very different than the national security context in post 9/11, because with health data, again, we've been doing this all along. There are conventions, there's a culture in place to protect this data and to use it in ways that are responsible. And more importantly, there's not the need or even the pretext to try to hide what we're doing it, right? And that's key to the recommendations we make, is look, transparency is eminently possible and desirable in this context. Not transparency, obviously, about the specifics of the data that's being collected, but the system and how it's being used. And if you've got transparency in place, you can do a whole heck of a lot more and trust that the data is being used for the good end of trying to protect public health rather than, you know, being reused and redeployed in different ways. And so I think that's, you know, one of the huge differences here.
One of the most interesting things that I learned in your paper was there's this whole background of immunity for companies in terms of their own risk if they get their employees infected with COVID. And I was hoping you could talk about that. You know, normally we would expect that places like retailers or just large companies that have offices and employees at risk, they would be pushing really hard for these apps. But I mean, it seems like there's not a lot of demand from them either, which, as you point out, might also explain part of why COVID apps have stalled.
Yeah. You know, it's funny, in late April, early May, I was on webinars telling people we should think through the a good policy and legal requirements for these apps, because they are definitely going to come. They will be here. And my reason for saying that is I thought that large companies, either where the employees have to gather, you know, in person, or where they're concerned about consumers getting exposed to COVID and then subsequently suing, I thought that they would be very nervous about liability risk and would therefore want to take every precaution. And you know, as I saw large retailers like Costco and Trader Joe's really push for universal mask wearing in their stores well ahead of, at least in Arizona, it was well ahead of the actual legal mandate to do so. I thought something similar would happen with an app, that all it would take is one big and influential retailer to require everyone who comes to their store to download an app and use it, and that would be the kind of spark that sets the rest of the chain reaction. And that didn't happen. And so, you know, Brian and I suspect that it became clear enough to legal teams and insurance companies that given that even the Centers for Disease Control wasn't willing to promote the importance of COVID apps in their guidance, that really no public health experts, at least of significant influence, were promoting the idea of using apps in the way that Brian and I think is quite clearly, you know, or at least potentially useful. Given that no public health authority was doing that, none of the insurance companies felt all that exposed by a failure to use an app. And sure enough, it looks like most companies assume, probably rightly, that as long as they are complying with official guidance, they are not going to be seen as a legal cause for the transmission of disease for failing to take some different precaution.
And Jane, just to clarify, when you say insurance companies, you don't mean health insurance companies. You mean companies that provide
business insurance.
Yeah, business insurance. So legal claims against companies. Okay,
exactly. Great. Liability insurance. Yes.
And so, you know, what's really interesting about writing on this topic is the world is just constantly changing in interesting ways. And these issues are sort of playing out and permutating. And so there was a New York Times article, I think it's today or yesterday, about the hot new COVID tech is wearable and constantly tracks you. So again, that's another theme that we bring out, is there's the press has been a little bit irresponsible in sort of really amplifying the privacy risks and not carefully thinking through the tech. But the story here is there are a number of private companies that are now expanding or adapting wearable technology that they already had to essentially do the kinds of things that the app can't do because an app on your phone can't do because of the restrictions that Apple and Google have placed on it. And so there are these Bluetooth wearables, and apparently it's a market that's emerging and growing quickly, but in ways that I think prove our point as opposed to contradict it. So first of all, you see it in contexts like the NFL, where they've got, you know, really high incentives to get this right, and a workforce that, you know, they already exert substantial control over. And so the company that was already had devices sort of tracking the player's health stats pivoted and now layered into it this proximity detection and some other things. But then even more interesting to me, MicroShare is a company that was already an IoT sensor company that was doing things, you know, the kinds of things that you already put into workplaces, you know, to have smart lights, to see who's, you know, in security and things like that. And they've developed their own wearable that's based, that's a stripped down Samsung watch, I think is the description of it. And what's really interesting to me about that is what's going on here? Well, in the absence of a really useful public universal app, right, that everybody could count on as working as well as we'd like it to for contact tracing, now you've got private companies that are offering solutions to private employers so that they can do that job themselves. And then the concern, which I think is legitimate, that's raised in this article, is that, well, the companies that are selling those wearables, they don't want them to stop being used when the COVID's over, right? So they're already talking about how to use them in other ways to track employees. And regardless of where you sort of fall on that question, it sort of demonstrates the point that if we had a really effective public option that had a set of controls and legally mandated restrictions, we wouldn't have incentivized what seems to now be occurring, at least according to this article, which is accelerating the already, to my mind, troubling expansion of workplace surveillance using the excuse and really the need of the COVID-19 pandemic. And so instead of getting more privacy by emphasizing a privacy and deeply privacy protective solution for a public app, we've instead probably ended up net as a society with less privacy, because now the private solutions that are coming online are more likely to get redeployed in the ways that we all feared the public solution might be and hasn't.
So let's now turn to the future going forward. It's mid-November. We're hitting, whether it's the second wave or the third wave or just the really bad part of the first wave, you know, case counts are skyrocketing. I'm in Minnesota. It looks really bad. I look at the New York Times every day and the nationwide COVID map is red. You know, whether or not we end up ramping up COVID apps in time to deal with COVID itself, right? Maybe a vaccine will come in the spring and all this will be over soon enough. It does seem that we're going to have a very bad winter, and the trauma of COVID is going to stay with our society for a long time. And there's no reason to think that COVID is the last pandemic. So, you know, looking forward, you both of you in the paper spend a lot of time really usefully thinking through how we can learn from this experience. And one high level point you make is sort of conceptual. And you argue that we need to start thinking about what you call socially responsible privacy trade-offs. And so I'm just hoping you could talk a bit about what you mean by that and what it means for a privacy trade-off to be socially responsible, and whether you think that means that the privacy trade-offs we're making right now are socially irresponsible.
Yes, they are. I think they are. So, you know, in a nutshell, I think the prevailing assumption is that privacy is a good protection for the little guy. And therefore, if you're thinking about society as a whole, privacy tends to help it. And that might be true in general. And then, by the way, the converse, too, is that, again, the prevailing wisdom is that surveillance is driven by reckless self-interest of the companies or agencies that do it. And that rule of thumb has gotten us where we are today with COVID, and particularly with COVID tech, that is. When I look at the last, our experience here in the US and in Europe as well for the last, several months, it's clear that we need to have a better, more flexible understanding of what privacy is good for, and then also when it can get in our own way. For example, we run through an illustration with a few, you know, fictional characters where because one person is sensitive with respect to privacy and wants to maintain full control over their data, because those preferences are embedded in the technology and norms and even potentially law, it winds up privileging that person's preferences over the other people who therefore are reluctant to go out in public because they know that the disease is not well controlled. So basically, privacy is one form of a liberty, but if it's privileged to the point of causing all the others to be undermined, it means that, you know, we've not made the right trade-offs between liberties, competing liberties.
And here again, we picked, when it came to the apps, privacy, and we didn't really weigh it against anything else. And that's just crazy. We're hurtling towards almost 250,000 deaths, and we're on track to lose 4% of GDP. But the only thing we can do with apps is protect privacy, and that's got to be the priority. And then let's see if it works. I mean, it's just crazy. There's so much room to do even a little bit more at actually fairly minimal cost to privacy. And the SafePass and these other, I worked with a group at Case that was developing an alternative privacy protective solution that would have allowed you to do more. There were so many more possibilities to try to make these apps work that, you know, it wouldn't have saved all those lives and it wouldn't save all that GDP. But man, it sure could have done something. And again, I agree with Jane, South Korea is the example, although you got to be careful with it, because South Korea did a whole heck of a lot more than the app. And it's, I've yet to see a paper that isolates out the app effect. Although, no, actually
there is one. There is one. NBER has one. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, yeah.
You cite it. I remember now. The app does. But in any event, but the point being that we're really just not making trade-offs when it comes to the app right now. So, and yet we're making all these other trade-offs, and we're now, you know, facing the really hard choice of trying, of deciding, are we going to, you know, are we going to do another set of economic shutdowns? Because we know if we don't, the death rate's going to continue to climb. And it just doesn't make a lot of sense that, you know, that we're stuck in this privacy paradigm that's really driven by concerns about consumer applications when we're in the public health context.
Right, exactly. So what we ended our paper by showing what we think could provide a good platform or starting point for the next pandemic. I'm still a bit pessimistic about what we can do with this one, but, you know, building on Brian's observation that one thing that makes public health surveillance different is that we can have transparency and accountability to a degree that is not possible when we're talking about national security. We try to embed that in our recommendations. So first of all, just to get over another potential collective action problem that we're, you know, that we saw emerge this time around, we thought it's wise to go ahead and just have a set of laws that spring, you know, that automatically become enabled when the CDC or the World Health Organization has officially recognized a epidemic or pandemic. And part of that set of regulatory tools would include creating a data repository, just sort of to start with the assumption that we're going to want and need data of some sort. But then also, it makes sense given the risks, the real risks, especially when it comes to geolocation information, to have very careful access limitations and requirements for data deletion as well. So another nice thing about this context is that with many communicable diseases, you don't need to preserve the data to maintain it for very long, at least not in identifiable or traceable form. And then we also endorse an automatic sunset that, you know, maybe one of the most important things is that either if the data collection proves not to be useful or efficacious, or if we, you know, if we manage to control the epidemic, then the entire program should automatically shut down without requiring an additional act of Congress or policymakers.
Jane, Brian, thank you so much for speaking with me. This is obviously an issue we're going to be dealing with for the foreseeable future, whether for the remainder of this pandemic or in the years to come. And I really appreciate you sharing your insight.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks so much, Alan.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. If you've liked what you've heard, please take a moment to rate the podcast or let someone know so they can enjoy it as well. This podcast is produced by Jen Patya Howell. Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo is our audio engineer, and Sophia Yan performed our music. As always, thanks for listening.